Okay.
Okay.
Wow. Welcome, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Wednesday, June 7th, 2017. And we are into our informational meetings now. And the first of them is this one, which has to do with agriculture. And we've titled it Oregon's Agricultural Legacy. And we have a couple of panels of people to share some wisdom with us. Dylan, do you want to lead things off? Or Dylan and Marianne and Nellie, was that the plan?
Come up, that'd be great.
Great. Okay, come on up.
Well, great. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Dylan Cruz. I am the policy director with Sustainable Northwest, located in Portland, Oregon. I am also a member of the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program Work Group. We will be here today to talk with you about the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program, House Bill 3249, along with a couple of my colleagues, Marianne Nash, Nellie McAdams, and then the second panel here. But more broadly, we'd also like to chat with you today about this concept of Oregon's agricultural legacy and the importance of maintaining our working farms and ranches in this state and the wide variety of conservation and natural resource values that they provide. So we will be giving an overview of House Bill 3249 in our presentation and then talking about some broader trends associated with farms, ranches, and conservation values in the state, and then handing it off to some practitioners to talk about what this legislation and these issues mean for them. But to kick things off, we have a video that we have teed up for you to tell a little bit of a story that I think nicely encapsulates what we're doing here to get things started. So, Shelley, if we can roll that.
My name is Liam, and I am 10 years old. My middle name is named after Captain Gideon Wolfe. Captain Gideon Wolfe was the first person to farm the ranch.
My name is Weston. I am 12 years old, and I live in between Lostine and Wallawa on the Wolfe Ranch farm.
My brother and I work on the farm with our dad.
I am the seventh generation on the same land.
Combining is my favorite part of farming because I like big machinery.
I like farming because it makes me feel happy. It just makes me feel like I'm accomplishing something.
When I grow up, I hope to farm on the same land.
If not out on the farm, we're out on the lake.
I'm glad I can go up on the East Moraine with my brother. It's fun to hop from rock to rock. There's so many views you can see of farmland, the mountains, and the lake.
The moraines are one reason the Wallawa County is beautiful.
I love the open spaces of Wallawa County.
My favorite part about fishing on my own property is catching something.
You have to look for it, catch it, see the beauty of it, and let it go.
Wallawa County is my paradise.
Thanks, Shelley. So we can move to a PowerPoint, but that's really why we're here today, is to talk about those kids and to make sure that they have an opportunity, the seventh generation on their property, to continue to manage that lands, to be the steward of those lands, to provide food, to provide fiber, but also to take care of those resources, the wildlife, the water, those natural resource amenities. So I want to walk briefly through with you today the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program and then hand it off here. We want to start with an overview of the legislation. We'll revisit this here towards the end of the presentation briefly, but to just walk you through this bill, House Bill 3249 has several components. The main piece of this is match grants for voluntary conservation, and that's critical when we talk about this bill. Everything within this legislation is voluntary programs, and those grants provide resources for permanent working lands easements, temporary covenants, and conservation management plans. In addition to that, we also have some resources for capacity building for easement holders and stewards, so land trusts and conservation districts, succession planning workshops in partnership with Oregon State University so that landowners can think about their estate plan and what succession looks like so that they can hand off their property in a way that they deem appropriate for the future, and a study of Oregon's estate tax to think about the impacts that it has on that succession planning process. So we'll dig deeper into these elements here towards the end of the presentation and then talk about further questions as needed. Just to give you a little bit of background on this process, and it has been an extensive one, but I would say that is one that I feel very good about. It's been one of the more robust collaborative processes that we have been a part of, and I think most of the partners that we've worked with agree to that. This effort was convened by Governor Brown's office going back in 2015 with the intent of looking at these working farms and ranches and thinking about how we can maintain their economic viability and the resources that they provide. And so the governor convened six nonprofits. You can see there on the side, Oregon Cattlemen's Association, the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, the Nature Conservancy, the Oregon Farm Bureau, Sustainable Northwest, and the Coalition of Oregon Land Trusts, in partnership with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board for strategic oversight and review, one farmer and one rancher, John O'Keefe and Doug Kramer, who joined us today to help put this concept together. It was an extensive process. We met every 2 weeks for over 1 year, in addition to a lot of additional conference calls. And we had 9 listening sessions held across the state, both briefings and in-depth listening sessions in the field with partners all across Oregon's geography to make sure that our conversations and the recommendations that we were providing were resonating on the ground with those landowners and working to meet their needs. Since then, this program has certainly grown as far as its support, and you can see the number of organizations and the diversity of the interests that are behind this. This is conservation, environmental, this is ag groups, this is business, this is academia. So it's touching all sides of the spectrum and is truly bipartisan in its nature, which is also reflected here in the co-sponsors of this legislation. Representative Clem is our sponsor, with chief sponsors from Representative Witt and Representative Bueller, and you can see the long list of co-sponsors and regular sponsors that we have: urban, rural, Democrat, Republican. This is truly a bipartisan and collaborative effort that people agree with across the spectrum. As far as our status, this bill was introduced in the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee at the beginning of the session. It was passed out of the committee shortly thereafter and received a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. And we are now awaiting referral to the Ways and Means Natural Resources Subcommittee to move forward, to be able to fund our fiscal, to get this program launched, get the guidelines developed, and take it off the ground. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Mary Ann Nash with the Farm Bureau to talk about why we need this program and what is driving our interest behind it.
Thank you. For the record, Mary Ann Nash here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. So there's a diverse group of needs identified when we start out to craft House Bill 3249. I think from our perspective, we had noticed there's a lot of projects that were looking at fish and wildlife habitat, and we have ranchers that identified a succession need and a desire to keep working lands working, but it hadn't been a lot of investment in kind of finding those co-benefits and those projects that accomplish both. And so we think this bill is needed to accomplish that objective of supporting fish and wildlife habitat, keeping working farms and ranches working, and leverage federal dollars, and we're going to talk about that a little later, that are largely untapped in Oregon and going unused and could be used to drive significant important investment on the ground. So there we go. Yep. So as I'm sure many of this committee we've discussed before, there's a lot of conservation benefits on agricultural land. 25% of Oregon, about 10.5 million acres, is in agricultural production. Those lands provide riparian areas, forest habitat, migratory corridors, water quality efforts, fish and wildlife habitat. There really is a diverse group of habitat values and working land values found on these lands. And making sure that those continue for generations is very important. And just to give you a bit of a sense of how that overlays with identified priorities, this overlay represents conservation opportunity areas that were identified in the Oregon Conservation Strategy with private lands in the state. And so you can see that a lot of the key conservation areas in Oregon, a lot of the key areas where we've identified needs for making sure that that habitat stays protected and stays viable, overlaps with private lands. And I will tell you that our members have noticed that as well. And are really looking for those opportunities to keep their working lands working while supporting these habitat values. So this is a big one from the farming and ranching communities. This is about voluntary conservation. So it's willing landowners, willing land trusts, and other stewards. And this was supported by the Oregon Conservation Strategy. They recommended voluntary approaches. I think the state has long recognized that you get a lot further working with landowners and working cooperatively than relying on regulation alone. So voluntary conservation can include easements, covenants, and conservation management plans, which we'll talk about later. And as I said, these front-end protective measures are a lot less costly and more productive than environmental regulations and just being completely responsive. So what do you get for your investment? And we'll talk about this, but easements permanently protect and covenants temporarily protect public investments. But in all three of the investments we've outlined, there's definitive plans to protect public investments, make sure that the agreements are being honored and that land is being protected into the future. And so, I'm going to turn it over to Nelly.
Thanks, Marianne. And thank you, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nellie McAdams, and I'm representing Oregon Association of Conservation Districts, one of the groups that worked on this bill. I am going to be presenting some information that we are seeing in terms of trends about who is owning agricultural land in Oregon and what they are doing it with it and will likely be doing with it in the future. So to start, agriculture is Oregon's second largest economic driver with a financial impact of $8.2 billion to the state annually.
Looks as if it's tied with the K-12 budget.
Yeah, I was just commenting there.
Driving.
Yeah.
We could use that right now.
We'll switch them out.
That industry is dependent upon about a quarter of Oregon's land base, as Marianne mentioned. And of that land base, of those acres, we expect that about two-thirds of it, or 64%, is going to be changing hands, changing ownership over the next 20 years. We came to that estimate because we're looking at the average age of those agricultural landowners, and 64% are over the age of 55, or were over the age of 55 in 2012. So we expect that it will be changing hands. And whose hands will it be changing into? Well, we don't really know. About 80% of Oregon's farmers and ranchers are estimated to not have a thorough succession plan. And we don't have a survey that has been able to really definitively say how well these farmers are planning for succession. But we know that 84% of them are organized as sole proprietorships. So from that, we're sort of estimating that they haven't had a really thorough conversation with their attorney about what they're going to be doing with their farm into the future. And this is a concern to us because an unplanned estate usually has more liability for estate tax, for attorney's fees, they have more family strife, and they often end up dividing up the parcels or selling off the entire land base in order to pay off those fees. And that not only hamstrings the business in for the next generation, but also makes that land more vulnerable to development in future generations. So we are seeing more fragmentation of parcels. As that land is fragmented, it is also becoming more vulnerable to non-agricultural uses like development. And it is harder for beginning farmers and ranchers to purchase because it is being sold very very quickly to the highest bidder, and beginning farmers and ranchers aren't able to enter and begin making arrangements to move into that property and take ownership. So we're seeing a great disconnect between this generation and the future generation, and we're seeing implications not only for the state's economy but also for our environment and natural resources in the process. As that land is changing hands, it's being purchased more and more by new sets of non-farming agricultural buyers. So that includes folks moving up from California, some of whom want to farm and contribute to our agricultural community. Some of them want to build a house and take the land out of production. So we're seeing land falling out of production. And land being fragmented, especially in eastern parts of the state, where a ranch, you'll need 10,000 acres at least to be able to support your family, but they're being fragmented off into 160-acre parcels for trophy homes. And we're also seeing an increasing interest from development and investment speculators. So Oregon farmland is a better investment than the stock market, and we're finding that investors are responsible for a quarter to 40% of the purchases in some Willamette Valley counties. That is increasing the price and making it more difficult for farmers to purchase that land, and we believe that those farmers can be better stewards because they live on the property. They have more of an interest in passing it on to their family than an investor. So with that, I'll turn it over to Dylan.
So the next question that we get from folks is, well, isn't that what the land use laws are supposed to do something about? Shouldn't we be preventing this? And in part, the answer is certainly yes. I think there's widespread agreement that Oregon's land use program has been extremely effective in slowing that development and open space and conversion, especially in relation to our neighbors and broadly across the states. However, in and of itself, the land use laws are not comprehensive. And we've seen that since the EFU program was created, 500,000 acres have been removed from agricultural use, and over 65,000 acres have been removed from exclusive farm use. So there is definitely a transition occurring there as we see population increases and opportunities for conversion. And beyond that, something that is potentially even more concerning is that there are currently over 50 permitted non-farm uses on EFU land. So even with those land use protections in place, we continue to see those exemptions being put into law. There are ways to get around our land use laws. And that's why we have focused on these easements and covenants as a tool in addition to our existing land use laws, voluntary tools to try to take it a step further and approach a more comprehensive outcome to protect farm and ranch land. So just a quick overview, a conservation easement is a voluntary legal agreement between a landowner and a land trust or a government agency that is permanently limiting the use of the land to protect its conservation values, removing those development rights and protecting the conservation values associated with the land in perpetuity. In the case of House Bill 3249, we are talking about working lands easements, which are conservation easements, but they allow agricultural and or forestry production on that property. You can still continue to farm, to run cattle, to engage in timber production. So it allows you to still use that property for those agricultural and forest-related purposes, but it removes certain development rights that are concerning from a natural resource and environmental perspective. We also have something in the legislation called covenants, and this is a new concept. They're essentially the same approach as those conservation easements, but they do not have perpetuity associated with them. They are termed easements that last between 20 and 50 years. Generally, these agreements are going to be held by land trusts and soil and water conservation districts to hold them, to steward them, enforce and monitor them to make sure that they are living up to the agreements and the requirements by law. And we have certainly seen growing landowner demand for these easements across the state. This has been not just a part of this conversation that we've been having, but for years as people have seen those exemptions, as they think about succession, as they are concerned about the ability to pass this long land on to people who will inherit it, their children, their family, or other potential buyers. How are they going to pass this on in a cost-effective fashion? So we've seen a lot more energy and interest in these concepts recently. So just to provide a diagram here essentially of how these easements preserve working landscapes in the context of this legislation and what additional opportunities are afforded to those landowners that take advantage of these resources. A landowner will convey a working lands easement. They will approach the program, the commission that we'll talk about here, to establish an easement through the Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program and the funding that it provides. And in doing so, landowners also are going to be able to form partnership with conservation organizations and agencies to engage in succession planning, to have access to additional programs to focus on environmental quality and other conservation-related interests. So it's not just about the easement. They become a part of a network, a core that can help guide them with their future succession planning processes and accomplish other additional interests related to conservation and production on their property. As a result, we have secure investments that are going to be permanently protected, or at least for a long term through the covenants. And for the state, this results in millions of dollars that will be threatened or endangered species listings by preventing habitat loss, by engaging in conservation practices up front to prevent regulatory oversight, and maintaining the economic viability by protecting the soil and the water quality on those properties. And with removal of those development rights, reducing the value of that property so that it can be passed on to the next generation of landowners and not bought up by speculators or outside of interests that have no interest in managing that land for agricultural purposes. So back to Nelly, just to talk about some of the financial underpinnings.
So Oregon Agricultural Heritage Program would be a match program for conservation easements and covenants, and it would match existing sources, the most notable being the federal ASEP ALE program. So that program matches easement value at 50% to 75%, depending upon the quality of the resources on that property and the threats to that. This chart demonstrates, so the green piece would be what NRCS's ASEP ALE program could contribute, generally half of the value. The landowner under that program can donate a quarter of the value and receive a charitable tax credit for that donation. And then the quarter needs to come from other funding sources. And Oregon has, our land trusts have been very creative in piecing together funding sources. However, OEB's current grant program is not a good fit for ASEP ALE. And so we are lacking a really targeted program that can help us access and bring in these dollars. 28 other states have match programs for ASEP ALE, and Oregon, probably as a result of not having a match program, has received very little funding from ASEP ALE. NRCS is very eager to see our state bring in more of these resources, especially for some of our more vulnerable areas like sage-grouse critical habitat. And Oregon has only brought in 0.19% of the total ASEP ALE funds that have been distributed. This is a comparison of states in general that have a match program for ASEP ALE versus states that do not have a match. And the difference is states that do not have a match bring in 68% less in the acquisition and conservation funding from ASEP ALE and 65% less in total ASEP ALE dollars. And they've been able to conserve 45% less in acreage. So this program is a huge leverage for states in order to access those federal dollars which might otherwise lay on the table. So pass over to Marianne.
And I'm going to talk about another tool that I think would be fairly unique to Oregon and that we're pretty excited about, and that is conservation management plans. So the program would also provide for conservation management plans, which again are another voluntary tool, establishes strategies for property stewardship, and it is separate from easements. They can be a part of an easement, but where we have a tremendous amount of interest is them interest in them is areas where we are seeing either current or potential listings, because they could help leverage some additional dollars and provide an additional mechanism to do some habitat conservation projects in sage-grouse country with streaked-horned lark here in the valley, with a number of other species of concern around Oregon. And so, again, they would be a proactive tool that would help prevent additional regulation and give landowners some certainty. I think they could function in complement to safe harbor agreements with Fish and Wildlife or NOAA Fisheries. And so I think they're a pretty unique and needed tool in Oregon that, again, we just don't have right now at the state level, and I think could leverage a lot of species protection tools here in Oregon.
Go ahead and recap.
Okay. Yeah, so just a recap of what we talked about. So House Bill, there's really three elements, and then the top elements divided into three parts. Big one, match grants for voluntary conservation. Those are the permanent easements, temporary covenants, and conservation management plans that we talked about. Capacity building for easement holders, succession planning workshops, and a study of estate tax. And in combination, all of these will help protect habitat values and help protect working land values. And that was, those two tenets were really core in what we undertook, is making sure that we had what we call co-equal benefits, and that is really visible throughout the legislation, that we strive for both of those values to be strong in this program. So the ask is for a fund for the Oregon Ag Heritage Program that would fund program elements and administration. It would be separate from OWEB, but administered through OWEB to avoid duplication of resources and tie it to a successful existing grant program. And it provides for creation of its own commission, and that commission would develop rules, oversee the program and investments, and be separate and advisory to OWEB, and really be doing the initial work and making funding recommendations that OWEB would then approve or disapprove. And the commission, we spent a lot of time developing the representation on the commission, and have a pretty diverse group of 11 members that represent natural resources, agriculture, tribes, conservation. So really we made sure that all elements are represented in the group so that they would make funding decisions, again, that are really meeting those co-benefits that we are striving to meet under this program. So, yeah, in conclusion, this program is a result of a tremendous amount of work addressing a tremendous need that we've seen here in Oregon, and one that we are looking to move forward this session. And I think you'll hear a lot from our next panel about where they see the immediate need. But, yes, so as we've talked about, you know, there's opportunities that we are losing by not having this program. We are seeing and ramping up, and we'll continue to see a ramping up in changing hands in agricultural land. Once there is fragmentation, you rarely see it reconsolidated and brought back into family ownership. And so there is a tremendous opportunity here in Oregon that is only, I think, going to get greater and more needed as time passes and we see a lot more transfer, fragmentation, and just moving land out of agricultural production. I think it really could change the character of what we see when we look out at Oregon.
Happy to answer any questions.
Yeah.
Sure. Thank you. Colleagues, do you have questions?
No.
Okay. Let me ask a couple. So in terms of the funding envisioned in the bill, are the funds general fund dollars, or are they coming out of the lottery funds, the dollars that fund the OWEB?
Yeah. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. So there's essentially two components here. What we are pursuing this session right now, given the fiscal constraints in front of the legislature, is enough money to establish this program and begin the rulemaking process, develop those guidelines, and get it launched. The fiscal associated with this bill to be able to go through that is $190,000 for the biennium. So that is what we are seeking at this time. Beyond that, funding sources in the future that could come from the state to fund components of the bill are coming from a combination of general fund dollars and then lottery-backed bonding. And we can look to lottery-backed bonding because of the easements and covenant components of the legislation, and that the state has an interest associated with those easements, so it allows us to use that revenue source in addition to the general fund. For succession planning, for the grant pieces that you see there, that's most likely to come from general fund or lottery dollars if appropriate, but we certainly have a diversity of funding streams that could come from the state. In addition to that, the way the bill is structured and the language is structured for the fund, we can receive dollars from private interest, be it individual contributions, philanthropic contributions, bonding mechanisms if conservation districts were able to pass a bond for conservation purposes. So it is open to private investments as well, in addition to that significant match component from the Natural Resource Conservation Service. So we leverage a lot of dollars. We're open to state funds and private investments as well.
And if I may add, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, OWEB's current Measure 76 funding is, as I mentioned, not a good fit for the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program offered by NRCS. OWEB's funds are specifically for fish and wildlife habitat and for water quality. And while this, while these tools that we're looking at would benefit that as one of their goals, they have other goals as well. And so OWEB's funds cannot be used for those purposes. So.
And are there, you mentioned there are other states that are leveraging dollars effectively. Is there a particular state that you would point to that is following the kind of strategy that we're looking at here that would serve as a good model where these dollars invested really have led to enhanced conservation and as well as retention of agricultural lands?
Sure. Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, Delaware has actually brought in more dollars than any other state and been able to conserve a lot of their really vulnerable lands, considering that it's a small state with a growing urban metropolitan area. Montana has also been very successful, so it can work very well on smaller plots that are really close to urban areas, but then also on ranch land and being able to conserve natural resource values on large landscapes as well.
And then finally, you know, in terms of the legal requirements behind, you know, with that are connected to the easements in terms of conservation values, I mean, how does that work? Is there's a contract that's signed that requires a certain return on that investment, or how exactly does it work?
And Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, I would probably refer that question to Michael Pope, who's our expert, who's going to be speaking on the next panel, who is the executive director of a land trust.
Okay, thank you. Senator Brooklyn.
So which of the tools in this bill is going to give us the best chance to access federal funds, or are all of them of equal value in different ways, and do they access different federal funds for different programs?
Yeah, Chair Denbrough, Senator Roblin. So I think the most direct link to federal funds is going to be permanent easements, and that's really what the ASAP AIL program is designed to complement. But I will say I was one of the members on the work group that was pushing pretty hard for the conservation management plans, because there is opportunity there to leverage NRCS dollars and U.S. Fish and Wildlife dollars and other dollars that are specifically geared particularly toward ESA recovery. And so I do think that the ASAP AIL program is going to be tied with the permanent easements, and that's going to be the most direct funding mechanism there. But I think with the other tools, there are still a lot of opportunities to leverage federal dollars and leverage private dollars. For example, in sage-grouse mitigation, those are designed to be 30-year contracts if somebody does, for example, a utility development. And again, this type of program they're struggling to figure out how to implement that now. And this type of program could help even leverage those private dollars for permanent protection and provide a model for conservation management plans and how to make sure that you're achieving the protection and habitat values that you're looking to achieve while still protecting the working lands and the working nature of the rangeland that sage-grouse habitat is located on. And so I think for us, it's ASAP AIL is type of permanent easements, but there are a lot of other opportunities to leverage other state and private funds with the other tools. And that's why I think we consider those fairly novel and I think a unique thing that Oregon could implement, and really, I think, see tremendous gains in working lands protection and threatened and endangered species recovery. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, Paula.
So do you see ranches or other agricultural lands where they might have parts of their land in any one of the three or all three of them on the same piece of property?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Roblin, I think absolutely. And the neat thing about it and the way we've designed the commission and the program is that landowners do get to choose what works best for them. And it's an agreement that they work out with either the land trust or Soil and Water Conservation District or whoever is going to be holding the easement. And so absolutely they could put part of it into a permanent easement, part of it in conservation management plans, and maybe even part in a termed covenant. And that's something that we saw tremendous interest from landowners in, is give me some options. And you know, maybe like one of our members was saying, I'm going to retire soon. I'd be willing to commit for 20 or 30 years, but I want the next guy to decide for himself and re-up it and work out a plan that works for his operation. And so that's one of the reasons that we looked at some of the termed covenants and conservation management plans, is to give people different options for even different parcels or different stages that they might be in their operation, where one tool may make more sense than another. And so for us, I think that's what is going to ensure some landowner interest and making sure that you're really reaching as broad of a swath of people as possible, and not just the early adopters that are going to be excited about a new program, but you know, a huge diversity of landowners that want to support fish and wildlife habitat and keep their lands working on terms that will work within the construct of their business and their needs. So.
So last summer I had the opportunity through a group of this group to come to Lane County and part of my district to go and look at a couple of farms, that in particular one. And I believe it was a permanent easement for parts of it. It had a stream that went through it. It's one that was important for fisheries and a whole bunch of other things. I got the sense that they could do just about anything they wanted with their property agriculturally, traditionally, or actually change the kinds of things they're harvesting, as long as they kept the overall health of that property. Is that true of all the easements, or are some of them that just say you can't do anything here, or others that say, yeah, you can keep farming and do all those other kind of stuff? And how do you go about, once you've given an easement, can you enhance the quality of the water, the streams, the other kinds of stuff? Do you have to get permission to do that? Or are there rules and stuff you have to go through to improve on what we've already got once you've gotten given an easement?
So, Chair Demerson, we spent a lot of time talking about that in our group, and I think we've designed the program in a way that the properties that have, I think, the strongest conservation value and the strongest kind of plans for working lands are going to rise to the top and be the ones that get funded. And with those easements, most of them will carry conservation management plans. And we talked to NRCS extensively about how those are administered within the context of existing NRCS programs, and got to the point, that was our landowner's question too. What can and can't I do? And how, you know, if conservation practices change, how do I make sure that I'm not obligated to do something that was what you did 10 years ago, but it's not what you're doing now? And so within the context of those conservation management plans, they do get looked at and kind of negotiated and discussed as they go, so that people can adopt the newest practices and can make sure that they're keeping up with changing technologies if they have a business need to change their operations, while still making sure that they're protecting their core values. If it's, you know, fish and wildlife habitat, if it's a riparian corridor, there'll be some things that they absolutely cannot do in the context of the easement that they have agreed to not do. But then it's designed to be that, so with their agricultural operation, they can still have the flexibility that they need to, you know, move between crops or transition between farming methods as practices change, because they do. And we learn more about what the best conservation practices are, I'd say year to year, if not month to month. And so they are designed to kind of achieve that flexibility that's needed while still having some absolute parameters that are ensuring protection of the resource. And so there may be people that can't transition to a kind of farming that, you know, if it would impact the riparian corridor. But again, it's, you know, farming in Oregon, you can figure out a way to do it that's not going to have those impacts and that will work within your easement. So we don't see that being a huge risk.
Last one. Are there different groups that hold the easements while we're doing this? And do they actually, and is it on the property recorded in the county, all of this kind of stuff that's on these lands, so that 100 years from now somebody is going to know that these things exist and who it is that holds the easement?
And Chair Dembrough, Senator Roblin, it is recorded in the deed, and it's held by either a land trust or a soil and water conservation district. Those are the two main entities that would hold and enforce the provisions of the easement in Oregon. So there are about six different soil and water conservation districts that have a land legacy program or are interested in creating one, and there are about 16 different land trusts that are interested in holding working lands easements around the state. Their coverage doesn't cover the entire state, but we're hoping that this program would encourage other land trusts to fill in that coverage. And in terms of how other purchasers are put on notice about the easement, I'll refer that to Michael Pope, who'd be able to talk about their protocols.
Okay, well, thank you, all three of you, for, you know, giving us this information about the bill. So now let's shift to the kind of deeper issues around land trusts and hear from Doug Kramer, Michael Pope, and Sybil Ackerman. Sybil Ackerman Munson.
You can still call me Sybil Ackerman. Okay.
Listen to we have you going first. Is that how you want to do it?
Oh, great. So I'm Doug Kramer. I live in St. Paul, Oregon, 19664 Arbor Grove Road in St. Paul. I was on the working group that helped with this. I was the farmer from the west side. The other, John O'Keefe, was a rancher from the east side. So that's how we kind of split up what we were doing. I don't know that I have any great expertise to share with you today, other than the fact that I've been a farmer all my life, 40 years. And I see a distinct value in working with conservation groups on my lands to try and maintain conservation easements and try and stay ahead of the curve, so to speak, when it comes to those conservation values, so that I'm not caught by surprise when your legislature passes laws that comes down and is going to impact my farming operation. I've been a director of the Marion Soil and Water Conservation District for almost 20 years, and as a farmer, I do think we are great stewards of the land, but also as farmers, we tend to get busy and stay inside our shell, so to speak, and we're not out looking at what the rest of the state is doing or even the rest of the country. And I can tell you there probably is times on my operation where I've done some things that in hindsight I probably should not have done. But at the time, it's maybe what I had been doing for a number of years, and it seemed like the right thing to do at the time. But if we were working with a conservation group, either a conservation district or a land trust, that we had a conservation management plan with, those management plans are going to be reviewed maybe not every year, but certainly every second or third year. And those are going to be the opportunities for me as a farmer to converse with somebody that's much more knowledgeable in conservation than I am. And they're going to recommend to me how to better manage my land for those conservation principles that are important to this group, your legislature, and the public. And so I just think it's critically important that this bill get passed that gives us more, as farmers, more opportunities to work with conservation organizations and bring that knowledge to us on a regular basis. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Doug. Michael.
Chair Dimbrough and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michael Pope, Executive Director of Greenbelt Land Trust. Greenbelt was established in 1989 and works primarily in the Mid-Willamette Valley in a four-county area. Our mission is to conserve and protect native habitats, working lands, and lands of natural beauty. Currently, we have conservation easements or have fee title ownership of about 3,000 acres. What I thought I would do is maybe address some of the questions that we had earlier, but also open the door with some examples that kind of projects that we do, maybe a few. One in particular is kind of a good example of a working landscape that also protects conservation value, and that's our Bald Hill Farm property. It's not a property that we hold an easement on, it's one we actually own the property, but we have easements held by either Bonneville Power Administration or Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. on the property. This property was acquired in 2013. It's about 600 acres. It's just west and maybe 8 minutes from downtown Corvallis. And we protected the farm and purchased the farm particularly for a number of reasons. One was for its strong conservation values. The other was to continue using agricultural grazing as a tool to assist in maintaining those values. And then to manage the forest on the property under a sustainable harvest system and to minimize fire danger to surrounding rural neighborhoods for public education, K through 12, and events for the public. And also to continue allowing public access to a pretty extensive trail system. We have about 30 to 40,000 people that visit those trails every year. So pretty broad recreational impact. But and so how did we fund this? This was funded primarily through conservation funding. It took a lot of work for Greenbelt, approximately 3 years, to assemble the funding for the project. There was a lot of conservation and a lot of conversation on how to blend the conservation values with our desire to keep the agricultural uses of the property intact. And we were successful in doing that, but we had to make compromises. And one of the reasons that I think this bill is very important is that there's really no sources within the state except for through the Farm Bill program to protect working lands along with conservation lands. We were able to do this primarily because of the negotiations we did with both BPA and OEB, and we were able to construct a reasonably flexible easement that allowed for certain rights on the property that included grazing and also some forest activities. The other aspect about that property was the development of a really extensive management plan that occurred over an 18-month period that had to be approved by the funders. And a lot of the details that you were asking about what is allowed and what wasn't allowed on the property are involved in or described in that management plan. And so the easement really goes into the details of these are the permitted rights and reserve rights, and these are the prohibited rights. But really, it comes down to the management plan is really defining what happens on that property. So another quick example was an easement that we did purchase on the Lone Star Ranch, which is a property west of Philomath, a 200-acre ranch that had been in the same family for about 50 years. The owners were in their 70s and early 80s and aging and worried about their health and wondering whether they could keep the property and the family. They had five sons. It was zoned for 2-acre residential development, and through a purchase of the conservation easement, which was funded by Bonneville Power Administration, we were able to keep the property with the family. Ultimately, the parents passed away, and their youngest son now manages the property. We were able to combine the grazing operation with a rotational system that allowed for the cattle to graze in areas where we wanted to keep the grass down in order for the forbs to provide nectar for insects and other creatures. And it really did allow for that property to stay in one ownership. So I think it was really a strong benefit. It was a working lands. And so those are sort of two examples of some of the things that we do. We certainly would take advantage of this program with the ability, if we could match AIL or other future Farm Bill programs. There's very limited opportunity to do that right now. So.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough and members of the committee. I am pleased, and thank you so much for inviting me to participate in this very interesting conversation. My name is Sybil Ackerman Munson. I live in Damascus, Oregon, and I am a consultant for private philanthropic institutions such as the Oregon Community Foundation, Lazar Foundation, Jubitz Family Foundation, Resources Legacy Fund, and others. My testimony today is purely my own. I am not reflecting the ideas of anybody other than myself, but I have almost a decade of experience in the private philanthropic world, and so wanted to share that with you today. So thanks again for asking for my thoughts. The most important point I want to make today is that the private philanthropic community has noticed the news articles and the research that shows that there is an urgency to this issue. And so in terms of the land changing hands, and what are we going to do, and what should Oregon look like in the future? And so the philanthropic community is going to engage and has engaged. There are many examples of the philanthropic community supporting both the capacity of land trusts and others to work in the easements and land acquisition arena and other places. The thing that's so intriguing about a program like this that you may be creating here is that the funders, as you know, we don't create policy, you do, right? And so absent a framework that you create in partnership with the cattlemen, with the Farm Bureau, with the environmental community, and with others, what we'll do is we'll come in, and sometimes it will work just fine. We'll come in, we'll support a community, we'll work on an easement, and other times it may not work so well. And then you and the legislature will have to deal with that question and sort of backtrack in terms of relationships that may have been frayed or other things. What's so intriguing about this program is that it will create a forum and a place where diverse interests can come together, and it will attract, most likely, much more private funding, first of all, than ever would have been in the state before. And secondly, it will allow for that funding to go to productive uses in a situation that really is going to be fairly urgent and is urgent in the next decade, or if not sooner, with our population expanding and some of these pressures increasing. So that was there are so many things I wanted to say, but I think that that's the main reason that I'm here today is really to impress upon you that this program, even in the tight budget climate that you're all dealing with within the state and public funds, this program could unleash support in ways and decrease tensions in ways that will end up saving you time and money, both in the near term and in the long term. So thank you very much for your time.
Great. Well, let me start off. Michael, with respect to the conservation plan that, you know, is kind of at the heart of the easement, so what happens if the landowner violates that plan? I mean, what is the mechanism for guaranteeing adherence to the plan?
Essentially, for us, and we have management plans, and we do management plans for nearly all the properties we actually hold easements on, which is not typical for land trusts to do that. But because these are typically funded easements, we were required to do management plans. And those management plans are generally done in concert with the landowner as well as the funding agency. But in the long run, it starts with, in terms of communication strategy with the landowner and developing, you know, understandings exactly what's in the management plan and the responsibilities of each of the parties. And so the communication part of it is hopefully something up front that prohibits or prevents any of that sort of misunderstanding or violation. If you get to the point where it is a serious violation, then we have the legal ability to take that landowner to court if necessary. So.
So I guess this one will go to management and those other things. So there's a piece of property in the Willamette Valley, and we decided to get involved and do something. And they are also part of a bigger group that's pinning because they raise different kinds of crops on their property. So how do those relationships that they have with their neighbors and others with respect to organizing and planning that get into the management plan? And if they choose to change crops, how do they do that within the balance of this management plan?
Mm-hmm. In terms of the management plan, usually what you build in the management plan is best management practices. If it's an agricultural management plan, it's built around water quality and practices on the land. And so it allows a certain amount of flexibility in terms of different kind of crops that you can and cannot use. We have a property that an easement that we hold on a property just north of Corvallis that's partially in grapes, and part of it's in grass seed. Also, part of it is in a wetland area. So in terms of the management plan for that property, the cropland and the vineyards are a separate part of the management plan under separate management strategy than the conservation values, which are managed more strictly by us. So
along that same line, weed control, invasive species, all of these things are happening all over our state in different ways. Do the management plans take into consideration the responsibility of the owners of that property to keep, contain, or work within the realm of those issues?
A good management plan does. Yeah, absolutely. It's give you some examples of the these management plans that we build are really complex and they're really detailed. They don't get into, I'd say, very specific prescriptions on a day-to-day basis, but they do talk about future scenarios and projected strategies, goals and objectives. And so you, when you craft that management plan, you want to build into it an adaptive management part of it so you know that change is going to happen, whether it's a change in crop rotation or a change in the forest condition or a fire or something. So you build an adaptive management component into it that addresses things like weeds and forest fire and all those things.
I'll keep going because this is something that has always interested me. So also, big issue all over the state, aerial spraying. So in your plan, do you decide how you're going to, A, fertilize, all of those kinds of things, as well as what kinds of techniques you're going to do to take care of different issues, and all of a sudden you get a particular pest, and
right.
Is it always best practices? Is it sometimes you say we aren't going to do this no matter what? I mean, what kinds of things do we do to make sure that you are being a good neighbor to all the rest of the people around you and, in fact, doing those things which make the land the most useful?
Right. Senator Romans, it is, again, it depends on the management plan and what you put in the management plan. But in our case, we're just talking about neighborly relations. We do reach out to the neighbors. We have public meetings. We go walks on the property, talk about the management plan, get their input. So if there are serious concerns, we've had concerns about allowing hunting on properties. And we've come to the conclusion in some cases it's not allowable just because of the recreational use in some areas and also because of the residential areas nearby. But other properties and farther out, it's more reasonable to consider things like that. But in terms of the pest management, herbicide management, that's built into the management plan, usually described in a pest management or integrated management system that you would have in the management plan. And for us, understanding that adjacent farmers to our properties are concerned by weeds, we really try to do a lot of outreach with them in terms of figuring out ways that we can control the weeds, probably more rigorously on areas adjacent to their properties. Understanding that you can't get rid of all the weeds, but what we try to do as good a job as we possibly can. A lot of that is described in the management plan. And it's not probably to the very minute detail, but because we want some flexibility, but it is taken care of. So
could be my last one.
Okay.
The other one, having visited places where we've done easements and other kinds of things in Tillamook County, you can do things that conservation wants with respect to wetlands and increase and do some things. And then the holding capacity of the water in that area grows up, and the neighbor next door who didn't have a wetlands now all of a sudden has a wetlands.
Right.
Or you take out a dike, and that dike creates an issue that creates issues for the people around them. How do we deal with those with respect to the people who are not involved in the management plan, and here they are making a management plan that affects them? How do we make sure that we don't inadvertently do things that create other problems?
Pardon. You can go for a second. Okay, yes. So we'll want to add to that. Well, just Senator Roblin, there's a lot of it is the design work that you do. If you're going to do serious excavation work and take out dikes or create wetlands, a lot of it is around the design work that you do. And also, we, as part of the management plan, we do a risk management evaluation. Certainly, we don't. And we're really sensitive to flooding neighboring properties or having any impacts on neighboring properties. We really try to minimize that as much as possible. But on the flip side of that, a lot of the work we do is planting floodplain forests, which really act as buffers from the river and help those neighboring properties on the other side of the forest be buffered from the impacts of any floods or inundations. I think a lot of it is around that risk management, which a management plan, a good management plan, really addresses in some detail. What are the things that you think you can do and you can't in respect to neighbors? What are the things that you need to do in terms of conservation? How do you compromise those two? So,
okay.
Janet Dimbrough, Senator Roblin, I just want to add two things to that point, linked to where I sit. The first one is the thing that is so exciting about this proposal and this program is that it's in the public sphere and it's in the public eye. And so, you know, there's a commission, it's through OWEB, it's, you know, people will be able to look at what these proposals are and really have a conversation. So that's what is very interesting with that. And I'm thinking specifically about Tillamook County in this conversation, right? Because Tillamook County is, you're not just hypothetically talking about this, right? You're
that's
talking
true.
About a real conversation that happened with a land purchase in the Kilchis, and then now there's a whole planning process happening in Tillamook County around this question. And what I could see happening, again, I'm just speaking in the top of my head here, but it does feel to me like this kind of conversation, that's a statewide conversation around easements and conservation and working lands, is something that can dovetail nicely into the conversation happening in Tillamook County now. It's a much broader conversation about, okay, how do we make sure that there are places that are protected and also that farmers and ranchers and all the different dairy cattle areas are protected as well with the water issues and other things. So to me, those two issues very much dovetail towards positive solutions rather than going towards the more negative that happened in the past.
Okay. Yeah, and Nellie was just showing me the fine print in the bill, and it does say that we are not allowed or prohibited from adversely affecting neighboring landowners with what we're doing in this program. So I think that, and I agree with Michael, if you have good design engineers that are putting these programs together, especially when you're looking at dikes and floodplains and wetlands, then you should be okay.
Yes.
So it goes back to the name of our program, because I'm one of the co-sponsors on this bill. I like the idea, and I want to have the conversation. My issue is that it's called the Heritage Program, and so I'll go back to Tillamook for a second. And actually, I could go to Coos County, because if you go inland in Coos County, that used to be a big dairy area, and it's coming back in a different way. You need land to have enough land to make dairies work out and to have the material needed to make cheese or whatever you're going to do. And in Tillamook, that's a finite landmass, and our land use system was designed to keep as much as we can. Sometimes these programs that overlay it take enough land out of the mix that all of a sudden we can't have a viable dairy industry any longer, and it goes away. And I worry about making sure that the protections are there as you're looking at each one of these individual things, that at some point it doesn't take it away. It's the same idea as the 500,000 acres that we've lost. You know, at what time does that make a difference that we'll never do this particular kind of farming again, even though from our heritage perspective, we were able to do that.
And let me just piggyback on that, and Sybil, you can probably answer this too. Just, you know, the way that you envision the planning component that the committee will be addressing, the committee that's created by this program, with the local planning effort, I mean, how those two kind of intersect. Presumably, they have to get on the same page, right?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Roblin, all of these pieces that you're talking about is the reason, I think, for this program. Because, like I said before, people are going to be doing permanent conservation easements. People are going to be doing a whole range of things, as we've seen in the past. And this kind of a public forum where we're having a public conversation and able to bring in these kind of conversations at the front end rather than at the back end and then sort of doing, looking back and going, oh my gosh, what happened, will save us a lot of time, money, and resources in the long run and leverage more dollars. So. Okay.
And I agree. This program is going to require landowners to communicate with their neighbors, communicate with their local entities, and so from that standpoint, there should be some alleviation of stress there. And the other thing I would mention in this is a working lands program. This is not a program to take land out of production. It's a program to guarantee into perpetuity the working lands aspect of this. And so we're not going to be trying to take land out of production in either Tillamook County or Coos County or any other area. There might be some additional buffers or riparian areas or some small wetlands that end up getting managed around, but we're certainly not going to be trying to take land out of production with a program like this.
Separate condition at all, and I just hope you can have some answers. My other concern is, I come from an agricultural family in Illinois and other stuff. Most of us aren't there anymore, becoming school teachers and other things. And so how do we make sure, if we save the land, that there's going to be people who want to be out there? I was loved, great seeing the kids, and I have some high school students of mine who are now managing a dairy in Coos County, and their kids are going to do it. But how do we make sure we keep that engagement of people who want to do this work? Because this is not easy work. I mean, this is, you don't get vacations, especially if you're a dairyman, and you don't get a lot of other time. You have to love it, and you have to have skills to do it. And so how do we keep getting that next generation of people to be in landscape? And are we talking about that at all with these conversations? You can save the land, but and you can make it working land, but if you don't have people that want to work it, you're in real trouble.
So I'll give you a couple perspectives, because number one, I'm one of three boys in a family, and my father's farm was not large enough for more than one.
Exactly. No, that's
I grew up
story.
Up in the Cornelius Hillsborough area, and I'm not there anymore. But I'm still farming.
Yep.
And I'm farming because there was some smaller farms down here in the valley that were being farmed by farmers that were getting close to being of retirement, and they were looking for somebody young and energetic to come in and help them with their farm. And I was the right guy at the right time in three or four of those situations, because they didn't have kids in these examples. My other example is two of my three children are back on the farm, and they're 33 and 34 years old. Is there a guarantee they're going to stay there after I'm gone? No. But I am confident that there is enough young people coming up and wanting to farm that if they decide they want to get out, there is younger people looking to get in. And I see them around St. Paul all the time. I have to agree, I don't get out all over the state of Oregon, but I just look at how many of the kids that were of a similar age as my children, and there's a large percentage of them that are coming back to the farm now.
Great. And so I would hope that the people who... The groups that own land, not just are involved with the management and others, but actually have it like you have your group, will consider, you know, leasing that land to this next generation. I mean, right now, I don't know how any young person who wants to be a fisherman in Oregon can buy into a fishing. I mean, the permits are expensive, all the stuff. It's getting out of hand with regard to that. If your family owns it, they could probably pass it on to you, but it's going to get harder and harder. And we need that next generation of fishermen and the next generation of farmers. And there may have been a time when they could buy a little farm and grow it into a bigger one. That's a lot harder to do today than it has ever been, and it's only going to get worse. So hopefully that we think about this as these groups start buying up this working landscape, that they figure out how to give people an opportunity to get into the business.
All right. Chair Dimbrough, Senator Robles, there's a lot of land trusts across the country that do exactly what you described. Vermont Land Trust is a perfect case. They purchase a lot of those dairy farms and lease them out or actually end up selling them back to a younger farming family at a really low interest rate. And they are, I think, 400,000 acres or a tremendous number of acres that they have protected in farmland for that particular purpose. Because of our history of land use in Oregon, that kind of initiative really never got started, but I think we're at a point now where we need to do something like that. I think we're looking at, like what Sybil said, increasing populations. We're seeing more corporate farming come up into the valley now, and as was mentioned, there are a lot of younger people that really want to get into farming but can't afford it. So if we set up mechanisms like this particular process to allow that, I think that would be really wonderful.
So just following up on that, you know, an interest that I have is with what happens to refugees who come to this country. And, you know, very often one of the challenges of our system is people come to our country who might have been coming from an agricultural background, actually in their home countries. They come here, they're put into an urban context where, you know, with the proper guidance and tools, you know, et cetera, they would really be much happier and more productive in a rural landscape. And I'm just wondering, are any of the organizations that you're talking about, Michael, taking that into account, you know, the value of immigrants and refugees as providing this much desired workforce?
I don't know of any in Oregon right now, but maybe Sybil could answer that question if you know. Do you know of any others? Yeah.
Well, this is going outside what I was going to testify about, but you are asking us. So I'll answer.
There's
some really interesting programs that are happening right now in Eugene. There's a wonderful organization, Senator Przanski. You probably know Alejandro Mujeres. And they have this program, and essentially what they do is, well, many, many different things. But one of the things, they spun off an LLC. So it's a long story. Long story short. They work with folks who work in the farm fields for others, but then now they have created their own LLC, those individuals, to create their own farm. And I went out to the farm and visited it. It was really inspiring. And they sell to, they make their own salsas and sell, and then the company that buys the salsa can essentially market it as a salsa that was made both organically and from the community, from a particular family that has created this, that used to be migrant farm workers, and now they own their own business. And there's just a whole lot of stories like that. Eugene is a major location for where this is happening. And then also some organizations like up in Forest Grove and some other places around the state where there are some really interesting things going on there. Not enough, though, I must say. But there are some groups in Oregon who are really working there.
Thank you. So I have one last question. We've been keeping you here a long time. Really appreciate all this information. You know, as I look at the criteria that are being called for in the bill, one thing that I think is missing, and I say that because we're really doing a lot of thinking about this area, is the extent to which easements or other such programs could be used to encourage climate kinds of action, carbon practices that, you know, whether we're talking about carbon sequestration or more sustainable forestry or whatever, that actually a value could be attached to that, you know, in terms of creating offsets and things like that. So, you know, I'm wondering, Sybil, I'm sure you operate in this sphere to some extent, and Michael, perhaps you do. Look at the criterion of, you know, improving water quality, supporting other natural resource values, whether you see a place in there for climate strategy?
We operate under the umbrella of the Land Trust Alliance, and one of their the nationwide sort of organization that Land Trust adhere to practices and standards that they set up. They've really launched a really major climate change initiative, and a lot of it is talking with regional land trusts and local land trusts about opportunities to do like carbon offsets, water quality issues, and everything surrounding, you know, changes in the environment. I think this program could really probably intersect with that, probably more in the large forest lands and grasslands. Carbon offsets, like a 300-400 acre piece of property, really doesn't offer much of a benefit, particularly if you're intersecting with the California market and trying to get funding through that market. They're really looking at 10,000 acres or more. But I think some of those large ranches and some of those large privately owned timber operations could really enter the market and have in other states and to some extent in Oregon too.
Chair Denver, that is something that I just organized a sort of conversation around that for the philanthropic community to think about working lands and how they can really contribute towards climate conversations. And there are a lot of conversations there and also organizations that are looking to Oregon to be able to make it happen. And of course, the Gilchrist State Forest is an example of something we did.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for coming and sharing on this. Important issue. No matter what happens down in Ways and Means, Senator Roebling can keep an eye
on it. I'm working on it, but I got only one of me.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. With that, I'm going to close this hearing. Colleagues, we have another informational hearing next Monday, and it is on something related to climate change. It's going to be a joint hearing with the House again, the California Cap and Trade Program and Rural Communities. And then on Wednesday, we're going to have the hearing on innovative wood products issues that we were supposed to have had last week, but the key speaker got himself a case of pneumonia. So we'll be doing that. So we have a lot to look forward to.
Yes, we do.
With that, colleagues, we are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.
Adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.
Colleagues, we are